When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I don't know what those white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institution. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
Welcome back to Black History for White People, a podcast where we educate, resource, and challenge white people about black history. I'm Brad, and on today's show are my co-hosts Katina and Garen. Today's topic is Reconstruction, and we're joined by Dr. Eddie S. Glaude. Dr. Glaude is a James McDonald Distinguished University Professor and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, and is also a New York Times best-selling author. And he is the host of a really popular podcast called History Is Us. It explores how American history haunts us and how our past failures and refusals to admit them continue to shape the way we live our lives today. He also wrote a book that we'll link in the show notes called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. It was a great conversation, and you guys are going to love hearing from Dr. Glaude, so we hope you enjoy the conversation.
We have a very special guest today, Dr. Eddie Glaude, who most of you should know, but if you don't know, you're about to find out. So, Mr. Glaude, Dr. Glaude, Eddie.
Yeah, Eddie, that sounds great. That sounds better.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And I know that your time is limited. We're just so blessed that you're here. We always start our interviews off when we interview African-American guests. The most important question that, you know, for me is, who is Eddie Glaude? Who are you? Outside of all this stuff that people rely on you for, you know, in the news and, you know, the things that you do, who is Eddie Glaude?
Oh, wow. That's a hard question on a certain level. Basically, I'm a country boy from Moss Point, Mississippi.
Wow.
I'm my mama's baby, Juanita Glaude, who dropped out of school in the ninth grade. Eddie Glaude Sr., who scared the living daylights out of me. So a country boy who made good, who's trying to figure out how to live his vocation in the midst of all of that. So, and, you know, I grew up as a nerd. I played Dungeons and Dragons and all that stuff.
Hey,
so
that's
read Lord of the Rings. So, you know, in the midst of all of this, I was the cool nerd, as it were.
I love it. I love it. Awesome.
Yep. I fancy myself a cool nerd.
Yeah. Cool nerds are what's up.
So I want to get into your podcast. You do a lot more than just your podcast, but your podcast is brilliant. Very well done, and want to push our audience there. So I want to start by just saying the name of it, History Is Us, which I think is the number one history podcast on iTunes right now. So I don't know if you know that. You guys are doing good work. And so I want to push our audience there, but also want to just open by giving you a chance to tell us about specifically, you started the Reconstruction era and recast what happened in Reconstruction. One of the kind of points you guys make is that Reconstruction didn't fail, it was killed.
Right.
So if you could talk about just what is Reconstruction for anyone who's catching up and not familiar yet, and then what happened during that era, and just give us an overview of what you've discovered.
So I think, you know, I think it's really important. Thank you for that question. I think it's important to give a little context. You know, in the midst of the insurrection on January 6th, this attempted coup, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas invoked the presidential election of 1876, the commission, or the what became known as the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877, as a framework for addressing the controversy around the 2020 election. And it was this ironic moment, you know. Not only might we think of, you know, 1876 as the occasion for the Electoral Count Act, which came up recently, but it also marks the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of the Dark Ages in terms of race matters in the country. So Reconstruction is this period right after the Civil War ends, where the South, the region of the South that was in rebellion, the Confederacy, is in some ways brought back in to the Union. It is a series of processes of how to reunify the country after the carnage of the Civil War. And so when we think about that period, you know, between 1865, after Abraham Lincoln is assassinated, and the period in which Andrew Johnson, in effect, tries to, how can I put this? He allows those Southerners who were in rebellion to just come back in with no consequence, with no account. I mean, it's really fascinating. But then, you know, the Congress takes over and you get Radical Reconstruction. And Radical Reconstruction is, to my mind, this moment where we begin to see the second founding, right? Mm. The emergence of the modern U.S. nation state, which comes out of the Civil War, which has everything to do with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the end of slavery, 14th Amendment, which gives us a different, more robust conception of citizenship, due process, and the 15th Amendment, which gives black men, not black women, the right to vote. And what we see are these kind of Reconstruction governments all across the South in which these formerly enslaved people are brought into the body politic. They are now taking on the burdens and benefits of citizenship. And they're running for office. They're participating in governance in the South, which really didn't have a broad-based public school, a public education system. These former enslaved folk begin to build that education system. Many HBCUs are historically black colleges and universities that were created within the context of Civil War being created in this period. And so it's a phenomenal, almost extraordinary act of democracy that the world had never seen, to take this number of formerly enslaved people and bring them into the body politic. Now, at the very beginning of Radical Reconstruction, there is the backlash. There is this attempt to undo it. Mm-hmm. And the Hayes-Tilden Compromise represents, I think, its culmination, symbolically at least. I mean, as early as 1866, you get the Memphis riots, right? Where you have white police officers, white citizens in Memphis literally attacking black folk who dare to act as if they're free. You get Colfax, you get what the historian Douglas Egerton says is that, you know, he's quoting Robert Smalls, a black state legislator from South Carolina, mm-hmm. who delivers his talk. I'm going on too long. I'll shut up. No, in 1895, on the floor of the state legislature of the House of Representatives in South Carolina, and he sees what's happening and he tries to put forward an argument, you know, bringing data. And he says 53,000 black activists have been murdered since the end of the Civil War. These are the poll workers. These are the black folk who are trying to organize in the Republican Party, just systematically killed. So we pay attention to the spectacle of large-scale violence, but there's this everyday violence, not only by the Ku Klux Klan, but by those Southern elites who are trying to maintain power. So what we try to do is to say, what does it mean for Senator Cruz to invoke the 1877 the Hayes-Tilden Compromise, as a framework when 1877 marks the end of this attempt at multiracial democracy and ushers in effect, the Dark Ages for the country when it comes to race matters. And so that's what we try to tell that story. We try to tell that story.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. So I have in my notes, 2,000 black men during that period, that high water mark, served in elected office. Mm. They're like sheriffs, there was a U.S. senator, there were congressmen who were elected. And so there was this surge of black men, black people taking up the mantle of being democratic citizens. And America had this chance to move towards a true multiracial democracy. There was within like the poor white community and the black community, there was collaboration on labor to work together to try to uplift the whole of the labor class to have better and more fair and more just opportunity to work. But then there was this systematic backlash that you kind of talked about, alluded to. I remember W.B. Du Bois in his Black Reconstruction talks about how in some of the southern states, and there's not good data on all this. It was the data wasn't collected very well, but in some of the southern states, there were 1 to 2 lynchings a day reported in that era. This white supremacist violent backlash against the prospect of Black people becoming equal citizens.
Right. And see, the thing that's really fascinating too, right? I mean, so, you know, even with Smalls data, right? If you have 53,000 Black activists murdered from the end of the Civil War to 1895, that's 30-year period. Mm. You're talking, in effect, 1,000 plus people killed a year, 5 people killed a day. Mm. And that's just the data collected, mm-hmm. right? And then when you think about part of what we have to do, I don't talk about this in the podcast, but part of what we have to do is not exceptionalize the South with regards to this violence. Mm. There is something happening, you know, when you know, most, the South really, the complicated story about the South being occupied by Union troops, because the removal of Union troops by Rutherford B. Hayes is basically symbolic, because most of those troops had already been moved South in order to execute the battles with Native peoples in the West. But what's interesting is that, you know, when you think about Jefferson Davis being under arrest, you know who paid his bail? Mm-mm. Vanderbilt. Jared Smith. Guy who funded, in some ways, John Brown stuff. So part of what we're talking about is that there's not only white supremacy at work. I don't go into this in the podcast, but there's also deep capitalist interest.
Yeah.
In maintaining that labor, right, in the South. And so part of what we have to unpack when we think about the death, the murder, the assassination of Radical Reconstruction, are what are the various interests that converge, that generate this the end to what was, in some ways, as Du Bois says, this extraordinary experiment at multiracial democracy. And, you know, it reveals that political violence is a through line in our politics in some ways, you know, and as well as greed.
Mm, absolutely. Wow.
So how does that, the understanding of that story, the understanding of Reconstruction being killed rather than failing, how does that shift the way that we should conceive of the American story and our place in it?
Such a great question. In so many ways, what I've been trying to do and what I try to do in the podcast is to disrupt what I take to be this very efficient American ideology. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we're always talking about that we're on the road to a more perfect union. That is, in some ways, that formulation that America is always on the road to a more perfect union, to my mind, it works as like a ritual of absolution, a way of forgiving our sins, a way of announcing moral holidays that allow us to kind of look past history that suggests that we are not an example of democracy achieved, that America is not, that the American story is not this linear story, that we're always already on the road to a more perfect union, progress, right? Mm-hmm. That it's really about fits and starts, one step forward, 2 steps back, that we're actually a very imperfect people trying desperately to figure out how to live together.
Wow. Yeah.
And at the heart of that is the reality of race.
Hmm. You know? Yeah, that recognition that progress isn't guaranteed, that the moral arc of the universe is long, and there has been a way in which over time it has bent towards justice, but if we look at that as inevitable or guaranteed and don't recognize that we can actually move backwards, then there's like an abdication of that responsibility to actively pursue justice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you think about after 1877, we begin to see the you know, it takes a period for the architecture of Jim Crow to take shape. Mm-hmm. But we know that Frederick Douglass lived long enough to see Abraham Lincoln sign the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. And he lives long enough to see the states of Tennessee and Mississippi passed the first Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. He calls these folk the apostles of forgetfulness. And we know that by 1898, which we're pressing it, it's early in the morning, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, right? That's not overturned until Brown v. Board, 1954. Mm-hmm. 1954. We passed the 15th Amendment that allowed black men to vote, but we don't get really, we need a series of civil rights acts and then the Voting Rights Act of 1965, right? And so America hasn't really been a multiracial democracy until 1960. It started in 1965 in some ways, when you think about it, right? And then, and barely then. And now we see right now in our current moment, and this is, I think, the point of the podcast, is that history haunts, right? Our history haunts, our choices haunt that here we are fighting the battle around voting rights, fighting the battle of a woman's right to control her body, fighting the battles around LGBTQ, right? Fighting the battles around whether or not we're going to be a democracy, right? This is our history. These are the choices we've made in the past, right? That have us by the throat. And so part of the work of History Is Us is to take seriously Faulkner and Baldwin and Twain, right? You know, Faulkner, you know, the past is not dead, the past is not even past. You know, Baldwin, you know, we carry history in us. Twain, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it damn sure rhymes, you know, that sort of thing.
So I want to talk about, because you brought this up, Roe v. Wade. Right now, the climate as a black woman to see you have pro-lifers who have made this issue around being pro-birth, for lack of a better word. It's not pro-life, but pro-birth. And we care about babies. We care about, you know, and I mean black babies, because of course they use all these statistics that to indict black women and the number of abortions with no framework for the history and how we got where we are. And then you have pro-choicers who are invoking images of the Handmaid's Tale and oh, you know, it's going to be awful from now on. And white feminism, it's like, it's going to be awful from now on, but it's been awful for black women. How does the history and Reconstruction, the death of Reconstruction, the killing of Reconstruction, how does chattel slavery, how does all of that inform Roe v. Wade? Because it's not just the issue of politicizing the womb that people make it. It's all the things that create the disparities. Could you speak to that?
There are a number of different layers to that question. And this, again, it's a great question. One is that white women in particular, in general, but white women in particular are experiencing, right, the betrayal that was Reconstruction. What does it mean to have a right that you think is guaranteed to be taken away?
Yes.
So there is this deep sense of anxiety and angst that they're experiencing something, I think, that was experienced within the context of Reconstruction. So that's at a certain existential level, a certain way of being in the world, a certain way of thinking about one's experiences in the world. But I think it's really important for us to situate Roe v. Wade within the context of the overall history of the country. I would urge anyone, it's a very difficult essay, but I think it's an important essay to read by Hortense Spillers entitled Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe. Mm. It's an extraordinary exploration of gender and slavery and the like, and the ways in which black women are ungendered in the context of slavery and what that means. You know, because black women's wombs are sites of capital accumulation, right? Because it's literally producing profit in some ways. And so there's this sense in which this one aspect of patriarchy is this battle over who's going to control the wombs of women, right? And so I understand that it's not just simply about babies, but in some ways the racial component is about babies, right? So you see, think about Roe v. Wade in the context of great replacement theory, right? That is to say, this idea that demographic shifts are threatening the very fabric of the country, that immigration represents an extinction level event, to use the Great Replacement novel out of 2012, to use that language by Renaud Cassius, I think his name is. The idea, and even it was actually even in the brief that was leaked, Alito was talking about demographic numbers and what's going on in terms of the birth rate and the like.
Right.
So there is this desire to control the wombs of women, and particularly white women, and they're not really interested or concerned about what that would mean for poor women, white or black or brown, or women of color generally, because there's this feel among a certain sector, among a certain ideological sector, that is, that this is about the nation. This is about, you know, the existence of white people as such.
Yes.
And so Roe v. Wade gets wrapped into that panic in interesting sorts of ways, right? And of course, we have to understand that, I think, patriarchy plays a central role in the organizing of this society. And with the revolutions of the mid-20th century, we talk about this, right, in the podcast, that the second Reconstruction, which is the Black freedom struggle of the mid-20th century, seeks to fulfill the broken promises of the first. But that second Reconstruction involved not only the Black freedom struggle, it involved the women's movement, it involves the gay liberation movement. And what we're experiencing today is a relitigation of the mid-20th century. And so part of the historical work that we have to do is to show, by giving us, by telling a thicker story about the emergence of the conservative backlash, which we do in episode 4, as to how and how they've been engaged in ongoing work to undo the gains of the mid-1960s, right? And that is to control women's bodies, to put black folk and brown folk in their place, to limit immigration and the like. So that's a... That was rambling, but I'm trying. No, I tried to reach for an answer there.
Not at all. And the commodification of black women's wombs is nothing new to us, and that's the point. Like, it is nothing new to us. It is the core of our existence as black women in America for 400 years.
And this desire, or this aim to control the, you know, the desire of women.
Yes.
Right. That yes. you know, your desire has to be only in the service of reproduction.
Yes.
Right? And so it's this ongoing, you know, it's, well, anyway.
So one of the ways that power was taken during Reconstruction, and we kind of alluded to this, but just wanted to like bring it out a little bit more, because you talk about it more in the podcast, is that all that white supremacist violence was not just random. It was not just sporadic, but it was targeted in a strategic way to disempower black people by removing leaders, removing, I think oftentimes labor organizers were targeted, voting rights activists were targeted, oftentimes ministers were targeted because they were at the center of the community and like organizing the community towards a pursuit of justice. And then I think there's like some parallels today that we could draw about ways that America's democracy is still not achieved like a true equality, a true multiracial democracy where everyone has equal representation. So could you talk about that kind of impulse to disempower and how that has played out past and present?
I mean, again, part of there's a presentist preoccupation driving the podcast. We want to account, there's a present, our moment demands a historical accounting of itself.
Yes.
And so we're trying to do that. So just think about one of the recent January 6th hearings with Lady Ruby and Shea Moss. These are poll workers, you know, election workers, everyday ordinary folk. They don't have the means to hire security. They're just everyday ordinary people doing the work that citizens ought to do, that we need citizens to do. And in their testimony, we just hear harrowing descriptions of harassment. What does it mean for the most powerful man in the world to target you 18 times.
Yes.
What does it mean for a mob to push open the house of your grandmother, the door of your grandmother, and to declare citizen's arrest? Remember, citizen's arrest was what got Ahmaud Arbery killed, right? So part of what I tried to do in this moment, although that hearing hadn't happened yet when we recorded it, was to emphasize that the violence wasn't just simply spectacle. It wasn't just simply kind of mass riots in New Orleans or in Memphis or, you know, Colfax or Clinton or these sorts of places, right? It was everyday violence, people being killed in their homes or in their yards, people being attacked at the polls, people. And what Doug Egerton says in that moment is that these were the people who would eventually run for office. These were the leaders, the potential leaders of the community that they were targeting. And then, of course, the terror unleashed in the context of Reconstruction, not just by the KKK, but by white citizens' councils later on in the mid-20th century, but by elites. Right, what's being unleashed is a kind of terror. If you dare to exercise your civic responsibility, Black people, you risk death. And so there's violence used to ensure that these formerly enslaved folk understand their place. They are being subordinated. There's another form of slavery, to use Doug Blackman's language, that is emerging. And they're being put in their place, and it's being maintained and policed by violence, whether it's extra legal violence or whether it's the violence of the state. And what we saw with Shay Moss and Lady Ruby and others is that violence, we heard it with regards to Brad Raffensperger. We heard it with regards to the Speaker of the Assembly in the state of Arizona. And we heard, I mean, over and over again, the threat of death, right, in order to pursue a particular political agenda. Again, that's as American as apple pie and sagebrush and buffalo grass. And for us to understand that requires, I think, you know, that we take off the blinders that can be American exceptionalism and look the ugliness of who we are squarely in the face, because, again, this is us. Mm.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Eddie, I'm wondering what you would say to, I'm going to ask my like normal person question. Karen and Katina have like these really deep questions, but I'm wondering if there's like a room of indifferent white male Americans, that's who I'm thinking of. If I could like kind of collect a group of people in a room and they're indifferent, let's not say they're like working actively against the country to make it worse, but they're also not doing anything to make it better. They're just lukewarm. What do you say to them in regards to, you know, we talked about a lot of things just in like the last 30 minutes, but like, what would you even say to them, to a room of people like that are just indifferent towards, you know, their life is fine. You know, this, a lot of this doesn't affect their life to them. So mm-hmm. Like, what would you say to that audience?
Their indifference is complicity. I mean, to be honest with you.
Yes.
It's not the loud racists aren't the problem. We know who they are. We've always known who they are. I think the problem are those who worry that we're going too far. What does it mean to go too far when it comes to ending slavery?
Yep.
What does it mean to go too far in terms of questions of citizenship? I mean, think about, I invoke this moment. I use Walt Whitman, who's one of my favorite authors, but he's a very complex figure. You know, I love Democratic Vistas, for example, as an account of the perils and problems of democracy. But when you read Leaves of Grass in its initial publication, it's a first edition, it's in effect an abolition. It has abolitionist aims. It's anti-slavery poem. It's actually a character in the poem that voices its disdain for slavery. But by the time of the last edition of the poem in the 1890s, right, all of that has been redacted. Not the 1890s. All of that has been redacted because Whitman didn't believe, he was anti-slavery, but he didn't believe Black people had the capacity to be citizens. Hmm. He thought we were barbarians and baboons, that we could not take up the burden of citizenship, even though he was anti-slavery. So those the group of folk who are indifferent, it is the combination of loud racist and indifference that allows for these moments of backlash. The combination of loud racist and those who are worried about us going too far. What does it mean? What does that mean to go too far? That combination is what allows for the backlash to happen. And so what I would say is that it does matter. It does, it is a deeply moral position. Right. And if you're on a mountain, to use William James's, the philosopher William James's language, if you're on a mountain pass and the storm is raging and you have to make a choice whether to go left or right and you choose to be still, that is a choice. Hmm. That is a choice nevertheless.
Wow. Yeah.
Does that make sense, Brad?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I would just, the thought that hits me in reflecting on that, it's like that we are human to the degree that we love. And that there's like an atrophied humanity in that coldness of just saying, no, it doesn't affect me, so I'm not going to have empathy. I'm not going to play a part of it. There's like a lessening of our humanity when we take that stance.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, for your own motivation, what drives you? You, from the roots that you described earlier, those humble roots, there's something in you that has driven you to go as far and as fast as you can to make the world a better place. And what has that drive been for you? And and maybe how do we get some of that? How does the audience get some of that?
That's, you guys ask hard questions. I was just looking for a quotation from Baldwin in his essay, Words of a Native Son, about, you know, what it means to, how we have to get a, how we have to convince Americans to care for all of our babies. Mm-hmm. That if you can't care for all of our children, then something is broken in you. As a response to the last formulation, but what's at the heart, I have a sense of calling, a sense of vocation that drives my intellectual work. That's at the heart of how I breathe. And so my task is to bear witness to the world as it is, to offer languages for us to think of ourselves differently.
Yes.
To create the conditions under which we can be together differently. You know, we're walking mysteries to each other. I keep saying this, Jaron, I keep saying this to people. There's an intimacy to America's hatred that we don't want to address. People knew who tied that fan around Emmett Till's neck and threw him in the Tallahatchie River.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They knew them because they drank beers with them.
Yes.
They played chess with them. Checkers, rather. They ate dinners with them. People know who attacked the Capitol because they're their brothers and their sisters and uncles and aunts and coaches. They're the ones that y'all tell at the dinner table, don't bring that here today. We're just going to eat. Mm-hmm. The ones who you know are filled with hate and you love them and you don't know what to do with it. And that, and I think that's at the heart of the angst and anxiety of the Civil War. Remember what's at the heart of the Civil War is brother against brother. Families against families. The carnage of the Civil War is rooted in this rift that was so intimate that it led to a kind of brutality that the world had never seen before. And so part of what we have to do is to figure out how to address the intimacy of our hatreds in the midst of the fact that we live such separate lives, that we cannot live in that power of love, such that you can see a child, no matter the color of their skin, no matter their zip code, as worthy of being loved, of worthy of being able to dream dreams. So, short answer to the question, which I'm prone not to give, I don't know from whence it comes. I'm a child of the tradition that has produced me. And I'm trying my damnedest in between these two momentous breaths, the first one and the last one, to live up to what that tradition demands of me. So
real quick, I want to go back to, because I think of Maya Angelou when she says, I'm the dreams and the hopes of the enslaved. And you're the cool nerd. And I think that America was not ready. They had already presumed us inferior. They did not think that we would take off the way we did after being freed from enslavement. I think, you know, just like you talked about Whitman, thought that black people were buffoons. There's no way they thought that we were going to become activists, start our own schools, run for office. And I want you to speak to just that reaction of black people just taking off, going from being enslaved, property, commodified, you know, just all the things that enslavement does and the presumed inferiority. And us just taking off, because I think there's a parallel between that and when President Obama took office.
I think episode two in History Is Us speaks directly to this. I interview David Blight of Yale historian, and Imani Perry, my colleague at Princeton. And Imani Perry is head of this. She's one of the principal researchers in this amazing teachers project that is housed at Harvard. And part of what we wanted to do in that episode is to kind of talk about what black folk did in response to the collapse or the murder of Reconstruction, in response to that violence. Mm-hmm. And what we see is this almost, I mean, unprecedented. I keep using this language, and maybe that's American exceptionalist language, but it, to my mind, it's this unprecedented push for literacy. When you see the push for education that happens coming out of slavery, mm-hmm. and what black teachers do coming around the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, it actually offers us a different story about the mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. Because usually we tell the story of the Black Freedom Movement as the kind of radicalization of Black men who fought in World War II. Mm-hmm. They go overseas, they experience freedom, they come home, they experience unfreedom, and they're radicalized, right? But what we see, according to, and Professor Perry lays this out very clearly in episode two, is that there are these schools, these Black schools, that are being founded in Black communities across the country. Mm-hmm. And these young kids are being educated in a way that they begin to understand themselves as not just simply victims of white supremacy, but crowns are placed above their heads, as yes. they would say in Morehouse. The expectation of a kind of excellence is cultivated in these spaces. And these young kids actually grow up to be the activists of the mid-20th century.
Yes.
And she does this beautiful move, makes this beautiful move by tracing the way Lift Every Voice and Sing became the Negro National Anthem in those very schools.
Yeah.
And so I think part of what the story of African Americans reveal is how the enduring power of the human spirit, that sounds rather kitschy, but it's actually true.
Yes.
But it also reveals how, you know, the tragic nature of the American experiment, that in spite of itself, you know, we reach for forms of excellence, but we have to struggle repeatedly yes. in order to be our full selves.
Yes.
So tragically, we are running low on time, and I think that I would love to just sit and listen to you for hours.
Yes.
And our audience has the opportunity to do that by subscribing to History Is Us. So I want to send everyone over, check out the podcast and hear more of the wonderful work that you guys have done there. Also, just want to invite you as we part to, in this format of a podcast, it's like you're speaking directly into the ears of people throughout our country who are driving to and from work, who are working out, who are doing these things. And just want to invite you, like you've been engaging with us for them, but want to invite you to speak directly to them, to the audience yeah. listener, to engage their hearts, to engage them. Like, what would you say where they're yeah. hearing you?
Wow, that's a heavy burden. All is not settled. We're not stuck permanently. in the station. We can be otherwise. We can be different. We can be better. I believe that this idea of whiteness fundamentally distorts and deforms American democracy. And you know what? I believe white people are more than their whiteness. I really do. I believe they are more than this idea of whiteness that has defined so much of American history. And the question for all of us, I think, is to do the hard work of imagining ourselves otherwise. If we don't, then we can, you know, then the Republic is in peril.
Thank you so much. Yeah, mic drop, right? Like, thank you so much for the words that you've imparted. Thank you so much. I mean, you just, wow. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you all for all the stuff that y'all do. I really appreciate
you. This has been such a blessing to just sit and listen to you. And yes, everyone, please go listen to his podcast, Eddie Glaude.
You also have written books. You want to shout out a couple?
Yeah.
You wrote a book on James Baldwin.
The podcast actually works in tandem with my book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you are looking for more information on what we discussed, take a look at the show notes or go to blackhistoryforwhitepeople.com. You can support us on Patreon for $5 a month. Check us out at patreon.com/blackhistoryforwhitepeople. On our next episode, we will be discussing Sojourner Truth. We'll leave you with this quote from James Baldwin. I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense, once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.